Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Lavender. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with a conversation between Mark Dunley and Larry Rullison on the Schoharie limousine verdict. Then Willie Terry reports on African Liberation Day, internationally celebrated on May 25th. Later on, in honor of Menstrual Hygiene Day, Bria Barthel interviews Ellie Von Welsham about her work on the Mooncatcher Project and period pantries. After that, Brad Monkel, bassist, stand-up comedian, and Jazz Sanctuary DJ, joins us to talk about his many talents. Finally, Barrio Alegria is currently visiting the Sanctuary campus. We'll learn a bit about who they are and why they're here. But first, here are the headlines.
Last week's freeze wrought havoc on upstate grapes and apples. Up to 35% of the apple crop was lost. The grapes were hit even harder.
The Times Union reports that farmers who received conditional licenses to cultivate the first crops for New York's retail marijuana market are sitting on thousands of pounds of product they grew last year but have been unable to sell, in part because of the state's languishing rollout of the industry. Statewide, there are just 12 retail operators, far fewer than the marketplace needed to support hundreds of cannabis farmers.
The Gazette reports that local hospitals and congressional officials, including Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, on Wednesday rallied for a proposed change in federal Medicare regulations, which could provide Capital Region hospitals an additional $192 million or so every year. The pending change would increase the region's reimbursement rate per Medicare labor expenses from 86% to 122%, the first adjustment in nearly four decades.
State Senator James Tedesco and Assemblymember Mary Beth Walsh are among those calling for the passage of Jacobs Law, to require schools notify parents when a child is being threatened by a bully. The state lawmakers were joined at the Capitol by the parents of 13-year-old Jacob Terrace of Moreau, who tragically took his own life as a result of bullying, and Isabella Cementilli of Niskayuna, who received a traumatic brain injury as a result of school bullying.
The family of Destiny Green, a teenager shot and killed in downtown Albany, is raising money for a scholarship program to help local students become dermatologists, a career she was planning on.
Over 50 people from organizations such as For the Many, Hudson Catskill Housing Coalition, Food and Water Watch, Columbia County Sanctuary Movement, and Rivers and Mountains Green Faith held a rally Wednesday outside Assemblywoman Dee Dee Barrett's Hudson's office in support of passing critical housing and climate legislation, including good cause eviction.
Zillow has ranked Albany as number 8 in a list of top 10 markets for college graduates in 2023. To determine the rankings, Zillow looked at each metropolitan area's rent-to-income ratio, average salary for recent college graduates, job openings, and the share of the population in their 20s.
That's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
Our first story today is on the Schoharie limousine crash case verdict. Mark Dunley interviews reporter Larry Rullison, who has been covering the case for the Times Union.
We're talking today with Larry Rullison, who is a reporter for Times Union, and he has been covering the aftermath of the October 6, 2018 limousine crash in Schoharie County, where 20 individuals were killed. And last week you reported that Noman Hussein, the operator of the limousine company, was found guilty on 20 counts of second-degree manslaughter. Larry, so were you surprised by the verdict, particularly after the district attorney had previously offered the defendant no jail time in exchange for pleading guilty to criminally negligent homicide, a deal that the judge, Peter Lynch, had rejected?
Yeah, Mark, I have to admit, I was completely shocked. I was texting people that just moments before the verdict was read, thinking, I think it the worst case, criminally negligent homicide, he'll be found guilty of that, but no way manslaughter. But I think that was, I had a fundamental misunderstanding of the case and the charges he faced. And in the end, I think it was correct. I think the jury probably did a really good job.
Well, one of the, I guess, mitigating pieces of evidence that the defense, I think, was relying upon was that Mavis Discount Tire, you know, testified that they had, I guess, lied. And, you know, they said that they were doing various repairs to the brakes, which were apparently the cause of the accident, when in fact they did not do that. But that apparently was not enough for the jury to overlook the responsibility of the limousine operator. What is going to happen now with Mavis Tire? I know they're part of the civil lawsuit, but is the district attorney going to bring criminal charges?
Yeah, the interesting thing is Lee Kinlan, Noman Hussein's defense attorney, during his summation and also during his cross-examination of prosecution witnesses who worked at Mavis, he kept bringing up that the Saratoga County District Attorney should investigate Mavis. And I guess she said since then that she's looking into it. I don't know how far she's going to go. I think the statute of limitations is about to run out, 5 years maybe. So that'll raise to be seen. But yeah, I mean, I think that the public, the PR, the public relations harm is definitely really bad for Mavis. In terms of the civil lawsuits they face from the families of the victims, I see that becoming more challenging for them. So yeah, that's going to be the story going forward, their culpability or not. So I definitely think that is the next big story in this case going forward.
So how did the, you know, family members react? And there were 18 members, I guess, in the limousine, but two were people who were getting food at the local residence where the limousine, you know, crashed into. And what happens to Hussein? I mean, I guess he faces up to 15 years in prison, but that has to be determined at a later date.
Yeah, sentencing is May 31st. And I don't know exactly how it will work, but, you know, the maximum sentence is 5 to 15. I've heard scenarios where he can say, okay, I'm going to give you 8 to 15. I don't know how it works, 5 to 15. I'm not really sure, but that's a long time in state prison, and I wouldn't want to be in state prison for a day. And then in terms of the families, when that verdict was announced, I wasn't expecting it, and I'm not sure they were either. And they just let out this like gasp of like surprise, but then it kind of became this like relief. And I'm not saying they were like happy, but there was like this joy of just probably being sort of like finally something I can believe in. So it was very interesting. I've never been through anything like it. Obviously at the time, eventually they put Nauman in shackles, and his fiance and his brother are really upset, and it's just pandemonium sort of in the courtroom in terms of emotions. But so it was quite the spectacle. I wasn't expecting any of it.
Now the district attorney, I guess Susan Mallory from Scarry County, small county, no one's used to trying 20, you know, deaths in a case, and received a fair amount of criticism for perhaps being a little bit over her head, but also not taking assistance offered by the Attorney General. How is she looking, and what are people's opinion of her performance now that the trial is over?
Mark, I don't know. That's the biggest thing about this case that's bothering me since the verdict. Why, if a jury, it only took them less than 6 hours, and they didn't really call for any readback of any of the testimony or anything. They had a box of evidence. I don't know how much they had to go through, but I'm pretty sure they were pretty united. Maybe there were a few jurors who wanted to do criminally negligent homicide instead of manslaughter. That's why their only note before their verdict was, what's the difference between the two? Can the judge explain them again? They obviously thought he was culpable from the beginning. So I am not sure why Mallory entered into that plea deal, unless either, you know, I know COVID had a lot to do with it, but that people were worried there'd be no trial at all ever if they didn't come with a deal and get the families some sort of relief at that point. But at the same time, in the end, she's been a district attorney or assistant district attorney for decades. I feel like she should have known this case was a slam dunk. So why did she settle? I have no idea.
I don't know if you had any opportunity to talk to any of the jurors after the verdict, but, you know, what was some of the evidence you think sort of just made it, clear to the jurors that this man had to be held, really guilty for all these deaths?
You know, the one juror I was able to talk to, and the other reporters were too, I couldn't find the jury for a person, said it was the list, the times Dominic Sand was told that what he was doing was wrong and that he should stop renting out that vehicle. And there were so many times along the way when he was told, these brakes are bad. The Mavis manager actually told them, according to this video that they showed, that it's a 50-50 chance these brakes will work when they need to. And that was before they'd been, the crash. So I don't know. I think it was, and then there were so many people who testified from start to finish that what he was doing was wrong and that he knew it. And that was all that mattered at the end of the day, that the jury didn't care about Mavis. The jury didn't care about the FBI, the jury didn't care about the dad, who was an FBI informant. At the end of the day, when they looked at what Naaman Hussein did and didn't do and what he had been told numerous times, dozens of times, and Susan Mallory and Frederick Wrench, the special prosecutor, laid that all right there for them. So I think in the end, that's what... that's why they came to their conclusion of guilty on manslaughter.
So in the last minute, how does the civil, trial, how long is that going to take? And is anything else from the trial that you think listeners should be aware of?
Honestly, Mark, I don't see how Mavis doesn't settle these cases. I don't think they want this going to trial. It would only hurt their reputation. I mean, if you Google Mavis right now, I'm not really sure what will come up, but it can't be a lot of positive things. So that is going to be the biggest thing. And then just figuring out Naaman Hussein's sentence on May 31st and go from there.
Well, thank you very much, Larry Rollison. It's been quite a few years covering this case with the Times Union. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was Mark Dunley and Larry Rollison with an update on the Schoharie limousine verdict. There are more interviews about this case on our website, mediasanctuary.org.
May 25th is an international day celebrated worldwide and throughout America to honor the continuing struggles of people of African descent to fight for liberation from racism, colonialism, and neocolonialism. Roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry spoke to December 12th organizer David Daniels about African Liberation Day.
Well, Taylor Terry, your Roman labor correspondent for the Hustle Mohawk Magazine Network. Today, I have as my guest David Daniels, part of the December the 12th movement in New York City. And they are planning on May 27th, which is a Saturday, African Liberation Day. How you doing, Brother Daniel?
Hey, Brother Willie Terry, thank you so much for having me on. I'm a member of the December 12th movement, a New York City-based human rights organization that really takes our inspiration and our teachings from the late El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, otherwise known as Malcolm X. You know, we think that his vision, his understanding is that the really top level objective for oppressed Africans, you know, African Americans, you know, in terms of, because that's a struggle too, to get to that point of self-recognition. But the struggle for Black folk in the United States is one of self-determination, one of independence, and it's a struggle for human rights.
Right.
So thank you so much for having us come on to share about African Liberation Day, set for Saturday. Our program is Saturday, May 27th this year.
Right. And, you know, before I just dive, you know, into it, first of all, just tell the little people a little bit about what December 12th movement is.
Yeah, thank you. Very important. Thank you. The December 12th movement, grassroots community organization that originally when folks came together, some of the founding folks of that was back in about 1987. At that point, it was called the December 12th Coalition. Some of the great leaders, some of them who have now transitioned and now our ancestors, were folks like Sonny Abubakar Carson, Brother Coltrane, Shimaranger, Father Lawrence Lucas, still with us, and the chair of the December 12th movement, who is still providing exquisite but most dynamic leadership, Sister Viola Plummer, chairs the organization. And it was those folks who came together back at that time because there were some particular things going on. As a matter of fact, up, you know, the northern, you know, the Albany region, you know, Ossining, where that was something sort of the catalyst. But I was brought to different folks' attention then that inside some of these state prisons, Sing Sing, Ossining, where the prison guards were actually really carrying out terroristic behaviors and torture, in essence, torture behaviors on Black prisoners in that, you know, word, I'm summarizing, got back to folks down in the city of New York, and people said, well, we've got to move. We have to deal with something. So there were a number of things like that. The issue of police violence, police brutality was on the table. There were you may recall that the big case around Tawana Brawley and all the issues and questions about that Black woman who was assaulted. So that was sort of the spark. But of course, those things were a part of a long history of Black people dealing with systemic racism in the United States, going back from, if we really go back to the root, from the days of the transatlantic slave trade and all the different phases of terror and exploitation for those folks, you know, our slave captures to make money. I'm talking about the slave trade, you know, slavery in the United States. And as our people fought and freed themselves, you know, to force them us to end the formal slavery, but, you know, all those years of Jim Crow laws, you know, the open lynchings. So that is what those leaders got the inspiration from. And that is what they've continued to do to this day. You know, we're independent, not a government-funded organization, but one that understands our struggle is not one of civil rights. We think that it is important that in our community we have people who fight on the level of civil rights. You know, that's important. We need to fight on every level. But in terms of freedom and self-determination, as Brother Malcolm taught us, that you cannot turn to your enemy, your very same oppressor. the persons who own the courts, who control the courts, who write the laws, who manipulate, you know, the prison system, the prosecutor's office, the school systems. We cannot turn to those people for remedy. We cannot turn to those people and expect them to be objective and independent in their analysis to help, at this point, over 4 million Africans realize self-determination and freedom. So that's why Brother Malcolm was very visionary. He understood we had to take our case. We had to take the evidence of the daily torture and abuse of our people to the United Nations. We had to bring our case to the international arena because it's one of human rights. And so that vision, those principles is what guides the December 12th movement, and it brings us to this very day. So when we come to talk at African Liberation Day, that is how we are able to make the connection between those of us Africans who are born, raised in the United States. Our circumstances are different here, but we are in the same, we share the same history of our motherland, of our people today in 2023, who are facing the same enemies who perpetrated the criminal enterprise of the slave trade. It's the very same people who colonized African countries. So it's the same enemy. If you look at certainly all the horror stories, you know, in terms of the human life, the loss of life, the torture from the slave trade, you know, that barbaric using force to bring Africans to originally Virginia and began that criminal enterprise, you know, that continues today in different forms. But we understand that African Liberation Day, and if my study is accurate, originally it was about 1963, to share a little history, when there were several African countries who came together and forming the OAU, the Organization of African Unity. And that, I believe, was the first coming together, and there was something that was declared an African Liberation Day. Mm-hmm. Because we know that period in the 1960s going forward was a critical point at which African countries were fighting for their liberation. Right. And it was, in fact, us Africans here inside the United States. And if I fail to mention Ilambe Braff, when I was talking about some of the founders of the December 12th movement, Ilambe Braff was one of those leaders.
You said around 1963, Kwame Nkrumah, is my understanding too.
Absolutely.
Was a key figure in establishing the African Liberation Day.
Most certainly, Kwame Nkrumah, very key in terms of having that vision back then, that this idea of the commonality of our struggles, understanding Kwame Nkrumah, as well as people like Patrice Lumumba.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Former prime minister of the Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, right, who understood that there were direct connections between the different European countries who colonized different parts of Africa, who understood the 1888 Berlin Conference, where these European folks came together at the conference and talked about how they were going to carve up Africa, which piece of the cake that they were going to individually own and conquer and rape and exploit. So it was these kinds of leaders, indeed, Kwame Nkrumah, Patrice Lumumba, and many others, you know, Thomas Sankara, who understood that we had to have a level of unity, sharing strategy. And so that's what inspires the December 12th movement, me and the citizen brothers that we collaborate across the country here, even today, which is why we must keep African Liberation Day growing. We must bring more people on board, because although our African countries back home and us Africans within the borders of the United States, we've made tremendous progress through our struggle.
Right.
Through our struggle, we have a long way to go in terms of complete economic freedom of our African countries, and certainly us oppressed Africans in the United States, who literally, as you know, Brother Willie Terry, who own nothing.
Right.
here we are in 2023. Tell me one thing that African Americans, or Black folk, as I prefer to say, tell me one thing that we own and we produce and we manufacture and we distribute.
That was part one of the interview of Willie Terry with David Daniels of December 12th Organizer. And part two and three will be coming in following episodes, or find those on our website, mediasanctuary.org. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Lavender. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by telling a friend. Sharing is caring. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
International Menstrual Hygiene Day is May 28th. Bria Barthel honored this day by reaching out to Ellie von Welsheim, founder of the Mooncatcher Project and a contributor to the Period Pantries.
This is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. 2 years ago, I started working with Hudson Mohawk and did my first couple of interviews with Ellie von Welsheim with the Mooncatcher Project, and I'm delighted to be talking with Ellie again. Ellie, welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tell us a little something about the Mooncatcher Project. How do you catch the moon?
Well, you know, there's over 5,000 different expressions for menstruation, for your period. And my favorite one of all is, I'm on my moon. And so when we first heard about this problem of girls and women not being able to take care of their menstruation, I thought, well, I'd like to design something that would catch your moon, something that's reusable and washable and will last for a while.
Why is this important?
Well, there's schoolgirls all over the world that live in very, very poor communities that cannot afford to buy disposable products. And what they do is they use things like banana leaves and grasses and old cloths and things like that. But to make matters even worse, they don't have underwear. So even if they use those products, there's no way to hold it in place. So what I wanted to do is to design something that you could wear without underwear, that would make it possible for these schoolgirls to go to school during their period. Very often what happens is when a girl drops out of school, her family will marry her off. So she ends up with a husband who's usually older than her by quite a bit, who's a stranger to her. He gets her pregnant, and now you've got babies having babies, and the cycle of poverty continues.
I like a phrase that I saw on one of your stickers, that a period should be the end of a sentence, not the end of a girl's education.
Yeah, that was taken from that great documentary that won the Oscar, oh, I don't know, about 5 years ago, I guess. It was just so fabulous. A period should end a sentence, not a girl's education.
You said before we started recording that you started this in 2011, so that's 12 years ago. Tell us a little bit about the scope. You're in a couple countries, right?
Well, we have sent our kit to, last count was 37 countries. We have sewing cooperatives in several countries. We have 7 sewing cooperatives. They're in Africa and India, but we also have sewing cooperatives that are financed by other organizations that are in the Philippines and other places in Africa. We started one in Haiti that's not going so well because of all the turmoil there, but all over the world we're doing this.
37 countries.
Right. Isn't that crazy?
And besides sending products to 37 countries, you mentioned the cooperatives. How do those work?
We have sewing cooperatives where people come together to actually sew our kit. We pay them for the labor. We pay them for the supplies. And then we hired teachers to go into the schools, distribute the kits, and teach about menstrual management and reproductive health.
And I know you said that you had started the education facet of it for both the boys and the girls. Why was that important?
We began to realize that one of the reasons girls were staying home from school during their period is because of the humiliation or the teasing that was happening from boys. And even though at the beginning I was quite angry about this, I began to understand that it's because the boys didn't have any information. So we put together a curriculum, and we now, as often as we can, we teach the boys as well as the girls. We teach them separately, and then we ask the girls for their permission to have the boys come into the classroom. And I love that piece because it really empowers these girls. They get a say in what's going to happen. And they usually eventually say, yeah, let the boys come in. And then they all talk together about menstruation and periods and how they can solve this problem together.
That's wonderful. So you're on an international basis in 37 countries promoting menstrual hygiene. So it seems like there's a celebration day, an honor day coming up that is relevant. What's that?
On Sunday, the 28th of May, there is International Menstrual Hygiene Day. It's being celebrated all over the world. There's workshops, performances, art installations, you name it. A lot of talk about period poverty, about the rights of girls and women to be able to be part of their community every day of the month. And what the Mooncatcher Project is doing, the day before on the 27th, Saturday, we're having a moon bee. A moon bee is very much like your grandmother's quilting bee. We get together and we make our menstrual kit. The difference is we invite men, we invite boys and women and girls, and sometimes people bring their babies, and just everybody's welcome. You don't have to know how to sew. If you do know how, bring your sewing machine. If you don't, just come and we'll put you to work cutting and measuring and packing and whatever.
And she's serious, listeners, that it can be people with any skill level or people who think you don't have any skill level, because there's a lot of pieces involved. What goes into a kit?
There's a carrier that holds the actual pad. There's a waterproof bag that you can put your used pad in. There are, and you get three pads. And then there's a drawstring bag that you can hold everything in. And this carrier is worn between your legs and then tied around your waist, so you really don't have to have underwear. The other thing I wanted to say is that this moon bee is in Schenectady at the Unitarian Church, 1221 Wendell Avenue, from 2 to 4 on Saturday the 27th.
Now, a lot of these products, if you are sending things or having them made in 37 countries, go abroad, and yet there's a need for such kits and for approaches to end period poverty here in the U.S. and even right here in the Capital Region. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah. The reason we give disposable products in the United States is that it's very hard for people, if you're living in a homeless shelter or in a situation where you have problem with finances, to be able to wash something. So we collect disposable items. We do a big push in March to collect items. And then all year long, as we do Moonbees, we ask people to bring disposables. We've also made a period pantry, which is very much like your free library, the little libraries you see all over the place. So you take a book and you give a book if you have one. And period pantries are like that. If you need menstrual supplies, you can go there and get them. If you're privileged enough to be able to buy some to put in these pantries, that's very welcome and very needed. Our pantry that we just had built by these wonderful women in Maine, one of them happens to be my sister, and her business partner.
Just happens to be your sister.
Yeah, just happens to be my sister. Their period pantry that they made for us, by the way, they call it the blood box. This is going to be put in Cohoes in an area where this is a need.
And there are period pantries or blood boxes. Gotta love that term. Here in the capital region already in Albany and two in Schenectady.
Pretty sure there's three in Schenectady. The Capital District Menstrual Hygiene Coalition is really taking the lead on this and making sure that there's period pantries in the Capital District. And I think they're planning to put some in Troy, too, if they're not already there. So it's pretty cool. It's written. Yeah.
And that was started by a couple women who were fellows in the Cornell Cooperative Extension Office who said, hey, there's a need here in the area for free menstrual products. And then they met up with you, and the rest is history.
That's right. Now we're all partners. It's been great.
Okay, and if people wanted more information about your Moonbee on Saturday the 27th, on International Menstrual Hygiene Day, how can they get more information?
Go to our website, www.mooncatcher.org.
Again, this is Bria Barthel talking with Ellie Van Walsheim, who started the Mooncatcher Project. It has expanded since 2011 to distribute 30,000 menstrual kits a year on average in 37 different countries. And it all began in the basement of her Schenectady house. Ellie, thanks for talking with us, and thanks for everything you do.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You can hear Ellie at the Moonbee on May 27th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Schenectady to help make those kits. And for more information, you can visit mooncatcherproject.org. Period pantries were mentioned, and the sanctuary will be a location for a period pantry very soon. More info coming.
Okay, WOOC listeners may have heard this next guest on Tuesday as the Jazz Sanctuary DJ. He's a bass player. He has also been a DJ on WGXC and is also a stand-up comedian. Thank you for joining us, Brad Munkel. Am I saying that correctly?
Munkel. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I'm glad to be at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. It's so good to be spinning for Jazz Sanctuary again.
Awesome. Welcome. So I understand you've been playing bass professionally for almost 8 years. Can you tell us a bit about your style, background, and influences?
Well, I started right out of high school playing musicals. I was really into punk rock back then, but there's no punk. I came from a small town in called Greenville, and there's no punk rock scene in Greenville. So I started out playing in one of my science teacher's bluegrass bands and musical theater. But, you know, since then I've really gotten into playing jazz, or just in general, improvised music, funk. I end up doing a lot of pop stuff, and I just enjoy playing the bass, so I like playing whatever I get the opportunity to play, you know.
So with the stand-up bass, are there versions of punk with the stand-up bass?
Yeah, rockabilly is like a lot of people. I'm no expert on rockabilly, but I guess that's like where you would see it the most common, the closest crossover. And then there's like one of my favorite punk bands, the Minutemen. They had some like crappy quality video of Charlie Hayden, like the great jazz bassist who played with, you know, Ornette Coleman, and people playing with them, like the Minutemen, which was a really cool thing for me to see. But it's not really a common thing. I guess it's something I wouldn't mind exploring more. I'm more into the jazz and funk now, but of course I would love to play with the ideas that come from punk rock, and it would be fun to do with something a little more out of left field like that.
Do you play other instruments?
Yeah, you know, I guess like after bass, next would be drums. I play the most of, I play some guitar, very little keyboardist. I was originally a really bad trombonist. That was my first thing. I was terrible at that. I've played a few gigs on guitar and a few like small performances on drums, but not, I really can't claim to do any of them that seriously. I wouldn't want to deceive people.
We all start somewhere, right?
Yeah. I'm just happy to play. I love music. So.
And in 2019, you joined us as a Sanctuary Jazz DJ. What brought you here?
Well, at the time, I was playing wedding gigs with, a bunch of different people. And I happened to be doing one night with Dylan Canterbury, who's a great trumpet player. And he was a former DJ for Jazz Sanctuary. And I just figured I'd ask him, like, how do you get into doing radio? So I'd just been thinking about it. I was terrible at talking to people, terrible at talking at my gigs. So I was like, I need to just make myself comfortable with the kind of thing. It seems fun. So
it was a practice. It was practice for, like, public speaking?
Yeah, I would mostly just, like, play music and not talk a lot at first because I was I was just, like, afraid I was going to mess up or blank on what to say. But
radio is about embracing mistakes.
I've since learned. and doing stand-up comedy has doubly taught me that lesson where it's, you're gonna mess up and it's okay. And
I was gonna say, you said you lacked confidence on stage and now you're a stand-up comedian also.
Well, if radio helped, that definitely helped. That made me realize, oh yeah, you have to be not afraid to look stupid. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of nice. It kind of makes me less afraid of bombing musically, like if I make a mistake on stage. But it's more about how you recover and being, like, confident and just having fun with it, and mistakes are going to happen. So they've all just kind of tied in together with making me more comfortable in front of people, which is, you know, the fun thing about performing, because I'm an awkward guy and I feel like I'm better at being a bassist than at being a person.
But comedy, you have the audience, like, giving you feedback right there. As a DJ, you have this protection of, like, the microphone. You're like, you know, unless somebody calls up or is, like, there, you don't know if somebody's reacting or looking at you. So, but how what's the link between the two of those for you?
I mean, I took so much time off of doing live stuff on the air. Even when I had a show on WGXC, it was pre-recorded, which is a little weird. It's like, there's a little bit of a disconnect, but since doing stand-up, there's definitely a more natural feel to just talking to the microphone, but it is weird. It's hard for me. Like, people say, like, oh, I picture the people I'm talking to sitting in their car or whatever. I'm not good at picturing that or, like, getting really comfortable just monologuing, but the other night, I felt a lot more comfortable than I used to be here, so I'm the progress is happening. It's just slow. I like improvising, but I also try to be prepared and have things to fall back on and things to say. And then when you're doing stand-up, it's like you have to be really prepared, because I don't want to just ramble. I want it to punch. I want to have moments, you know. And that is also another thing that, you know, I try to bring back to music now that I've done that, is like, how can I make if I'm planning a musical set, how can I give it punchlines? How can I make it as, like, economical as comedians are with their sets?
Yeah, absolutely. So you were here Tuesday, but is it true that you've also been joining us weekly every Tuesday?
Oh, I've been talking with Susan, the head of Jazz Sanctuary, and I'm going to come back next Tuesday. I'm going to be hanging around on Tuesdays for a while because it's good to be back. And, you know, usually I'll do some, like, open mic spots on Tuesdays, but why not one day a week get back into doing more radio? Because I've been out of that since I left WGXC, and I do really enjoy it. I really like looking through the music collection here and finding out about the new releases. And I am also probably going to be starting to do some interviews for the station. So I'm glad I'm going to be back. Like I said, it's good to be back here, and I'm glad Susan is doing the show again.
So you started as a DJ, barely speaking and playing mostly music. And then at WGXC, you were doing a lot of interviewing. What was that breaking, that kind of interaction with the musicians? Like, what did you take away from doing interviews?
Just like the other stuff, it's like I just had to force myself to get comfortable and not worry about mistakes. So, like, you know, Jazz Sanctuary had to stop when the pandemic started. And then I quickly, after, like, you know, a couple months, I was bored because all my gigs were canceled. And I started looking for a new radio show because I just missed doing it and I wanted some more stuff to do. And And so I got that going. And in the first episode, again, it's pre-programmed, so I like line up all these songs in Pro Tools, which is a lot of work, and I send that show. And I was like, that wasn't very fun, DJing a pre-recorded show. And I have this time slot, so I just made myself just start bugging people on Instagram, bugging people on Facebook. And you would be surprised at the people who will get back to you. I've interviewed some of my favorite drummers and bassists, and it just takes building and doing it over and over again. And you know, like I said, not being afraid to mess up or look dumb or just try.
Well, we're just about out of time, but with these interviews from WGXC, are you going to bring some of that content to WOOC?
I mean, honestly, I'm just excited that I don't have to pre-record it anymore. It's going to be, you know, the vibe of being in the studio and talking with these people and, you know, being in, like, having the support of the radio station and Susan and everything, I feel like it'll just be an even more comfortable environment for me to do it. And I love talking to artists, so I'm really looking forward to it. I always enjoy a good interview.
So Tuesdays, Jazz Sanctuary from 7 to 10 p.m. Where else can listeners learn more about the work that you're doing?
Well, I host a comedy open mic every Wednesday at 518 Craft in Troy. And I'm starting next month on Sundays, I'm going to be hosting a jazzy funk jam there. And if you follow Albany Comedy on Facebook or Instagram, there's posts about all the other comedy open mics that happen during the week. And I'll be playing the first Sunday next month at Lark Tavern. And yeah, other stuff coming up.
Great. It's been a pleasure to get to know the voice behind, or the person behind the voice.
Well, yeah, I really appreciate all that you guys do here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And thank you for having me. And it's a pleasure to talk to both of you.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
And we end tonight's show with an interview with the group Barrio Alegria. And when they were at the Sanctuary, which is this Thursday and Friday, I spoke with them about what they're doing. For 2 days, Barrio Alegria were visiting the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And joining me now is
Anthony Orozco.
Wonderful. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So what brings Barrio Alegria to North Troy?
Barrio Alegria is a community engagement organization that really utilizes storytelling. And we've heard the lore about the Sanctuary for Independent Media and really just want to know how we can be a little bit more like you guys and empower people by amplifying their voices and their stories.
And where are you based?
We're based in Reading, Pennsylvania, which is about an hour away from Philadelphia.
And how do the places compare?
Philadelphia is, you know, a proper city, proper metropolitan area. Reading, being about an hour away, is far removed from the suburbs, the collar counties of Philly, and is a city in the middle of Penny Dutch country. Also, Pennsylvania has a archipelago of these Latino majority cities that find themselves based in Pennsylvania Dutch country.
So storytelling, that can be so many things. I heard about financial literacy and inherited trauma around money. Mm-hmm. We were also talking about grants to different organizations. Could you give us a little bit of an overview of the different ways that your organization distributes into the community and works in storytelling?
Yeah, we do a couple of things. One is our community building, which works in the financial realm of attacking or looking at, examining, analyzing people's emotional connection to money, you know, their first memories of money. Did you know as a child what day payday was? Some people did not have to worry about that. Some of us knew very well when our parents were getting paid. So there is, you know, a whole labyrinth of emotions and experiences that tie people to money. And so as part of our financial literacy course, we have people looking at that, examining that, trying to understand where they are in terms of their connection with money. And then we have other things like leadership development, where we try to identify people who want to make a positive change in their community and maybe don't know how, but they have that heart. And you can train somebody to be an actor in the community who does something, but you can't instill heart in people. And so we identify people who have that barrio DNA and then give them the skills to become leaders. And then in creative placemaking, placekeeping, we tell stories that are culturally competent to our people, things that they recognize, understand, live with, struggle with, their triumphs and their trials. So that is done through annual performances that we do, dramas, plays, poetry, and all sorts of art forms.
Maybe not everybody is familiar with the term placemaking or creative placemaking. How would you describe that?
Creative placemaking for me, you talk to people in organizations who utilized creative placemaking or placekeeping, and you'll hear different definitions from different people. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's claiming ownership, staking, really planting your flag in the ground and saying, you know what, we're going to occupy this space. We're going to hold this space. We're going to protect this space. We've identified locations in the city of Reading that are underloved and usually come with negative perceptions or connotations of these areas. We go in there, we transform them. I mean, really, our entire mission revolves around transformation, individual places and perceptions. So we have planted our flags in these places. So we go there, we show up, we make them beautiful. We make them portals for beauty, light, elegance, and excellence is what I like to say. But now we are in placekeeping, where we keep showing up. It's very easy. We see a million of these things pop up and die off. I mean, that's a symptom maybe for many Rust Belt cities, is that you see passionate people say, we want to do something. And then they have a performance or they have a series of workshops. And then it sort of falls apart and disintegrates. But Barrio is committed to keeping its promises. And our promises are to reflect the beauty and opportunity and potential in our people and our places. So it's returning to these places, making sure that they're not underloved, that they're properly loved, cared for, and that we bring something that will probably change the perception of those places.
Barrio Alegria has been around for how long?
8 years.
So over those 8 years, how have you seen the transformation around?
Oh my gosh. Well, transformation from Barrio itself started as a dance troupe. And then it started out
a different type of storytelling with the body and movements.
Exactly. And we actually, our annual performance that I talked about, that I mentioned earlier, is called Storytelling Through Dance. So mm-hmm. using all sorts of art forms to tell our stories. But yeah, it started as a salsa, like dance club thing. And then it turned into more art forms, and it was like a patchwork of photography, poetry nights, and then dance. And now it has become a whole other animal where we have very focused pillars that are trying to empower people.
We think of storytelling, we think of verbal, written, but through dancing and arts-based creative storytelling avenues, how do you see it sitting with people differently and maybe gravitating different folks?
Well, just like our group, you know, some people don't speak English super fluently. Some of us don't speak Spanish super fluently. I mean, our name, Barrio Alegria. There's tons of people listening to this who won't know what that means. It means neighborhood of happiness. But we in Reading face a lot of language barriers. Art is a universal language that we all speak with in our hearts and in our souls. And so through art, we don't need correct pronunciation or the right vocabulary word. It's addressing sort of these underlying currents that rest right below our conscious. And when we connect with that, I think we connect with the common human spirit that doesn't need all the things that we've learned. It connects to the ether, you know, the ether cord of existence. It speaks to something deeper, that you don't need language. You don't need things written out. All you need is to feel something. So we see our gravitational pull bring in all sorts of people from all sorts of different walks of life and income and experiences because they can connect on that deeper level.
We're recording this about at the end of the first of 2 days here at the Sanctuary campus. What has some of your group been noticing about the Sanctuary in North Troy, maybe in relationship to Reading and Barrio Alegría? What are some observations?
Oh, man. My eyes are hungry. I'm eating everything up while I'm here. A lot of similarities, as I mentioned earlier, about, you know, Rust Belt cities, post-industrial, you know, trying to find its identity, up and coming, you know, that sort of feeling of not wanting to be identified as a small town. And then really what I've been impressed with the Sanctuary is the utilization and liberation of spaces, of underloved spaces, of these abandoned homes and, you know, things that you have transformed in a very real way. Not just in feeling or how people perceive it, but very tangibly changing things to provide resources for people. That's really exciting for me, and I think is in future chapters for Barrio.
So after your group does a site visit, you see what other people are doing. What tangibly comes out of a visit?
Oh, man. So in these learning exchanges, for us, we go back, we debrief. Debriefing is real big for us to make sure that we have digested or take viewpoints, that we mix each other's opinions and ideas and come out with something, like you said, something that we can use. What can we use? So I think some of the information that you've already shared with us about training volunteers, utilizing volunteers, creating community, and land banking, that's something that I've already taken away and that I've like filed away in my notes to research more because, yeah, we're always looking for ways to lift up our people. And there's so many different ways to do it. And entrusting them is a big part of it, but not just entrusting them blindly and letting them fail on their own. Never will we do that. I really, really love that you guys give them some training, give them a foundation, give them feedback, and build them up instead of just say, all right, you're on your own. See you later. Good luck with your story. No, it's if you want leaders in your community, you have to find them and build them.
This has been super fun. I'm really looking forward to tomorrow. You'll be out in the garden. So thank you so much, Anthony, for joining me today on Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
For more information, visit barrioalegria.com. And if you don't know how to spell that, just remember it is the Village of Happiness. And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Lavender. Our engineer today is Sina Bazila-Hickey. We want to thank all of the volunteers who made this episode possible. Contributors to today's episode are Mark Dunley, Willie Terry, Bria Barthel, and me, Lavender. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a Sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
We want to hear from you. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Media Sanctuary, or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at our website and on your favorite podcast platform. We appreciate you listening. Until next time.